This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
SFF Yeah, a podcast dedicated to all things science fiction and fantasy. This is episode 166, and we are recording on December 8th. I'm Jen Worthington. I'm here with Vanessa Diaz, who is filling in for Sharifa, who just had twins.
Yay!
FYI. Hooray!
Yay!
So she's going to be gone for a little while, you know, doing the family leave thing, and we're going to have some fill-in hosts for a hot minute. So welcome, Vanessa, our first fill-in. And, you know, I love having you on the show.
I love being here, but it is. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm the first one on. Like, yay, filling some shoes. But it's great to be back. We're very happy for Sharifa.
Yes.
And it's, yeah, I love jumping on these, like, kind of end-of-year type shows anyway. I feel like we get real loose and fun.
We sure do. Today, I am so glad you were up for this topic because I had it planned, like, when we still didn't know when, you know, Sharifa was going to be in and out. So today, not to, like, you know, hide it any longer, we're talking about pet peeves and favorite tropes in science fiction and fantasy. I love doing this kind of show because it's, like, you know, you can get in your feels a little bit. Here we are. That's what we're going to do. Before we get into all of that, and we'll talk a little bit about how we approach the question too at the after we do all the newsy stuff. So before we even get to that part, though, reminder that TBR now has paperbacks. It's true. We finally made it happen. So whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, or you know some reader in your life, you know, for holiday gifting, because the holidays, they are now here, you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you or your special someone by our bibliologists. We also have a digital-only level, and we have hardcovers in the mail if you really want to go luxe. All of the details are at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. Go check it out. And now we will hear from a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And Who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
All right, Vanessa, what news do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about some best books since, you know, tis the season.
Tis.
All the best books lists everywhere. There's so many I can barely keep up. But what we're talking about today is Publishers Weekly's best books of 2023, specifically, of course, the SFF picks. I love best of lists because they help build my TBR, but I also become very painfully aware of what I have not read. And this is another example. I own, I think, three of the books on this list. I have partially started them, but don't think I've actually read most of them all the way through. So there are, what's it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 picks. Some of the top line there are Chang Gang All-Stars, which I think none of us are like surprised to see, by Nana Kwame Ajay Brenya. The Circumference of the World by Lavi Tadar. Like Smoke Like Light by Yukimi Ogawa. Our Share of Night by Mariana Enriquez. I'm just going to give them all to you because there's not that many. Some Desperate Glory by Emily Tesh. Translation State by Anne Leckie. And The Water Outlaws by S.L. Huang. What are your thoughts on this list?
I mean, it's an interesting list. Yeah, I had heard of all but one of these.
Me too.
And was not surprised particularly. Although this mix is an interesting mix, right? Because, yep. You know, I did that big spreadsheet, which we're going to talk about in a future show, of what was getting attention for Best Of in 2023. Mm-hmm. And like Our Share of Night, you know, popped up a lot. Chang Gang All-Stars, obviously. You know, and like, you know, Leckie is a known blockbuster author. Lavi Tadar has been publishing forever and is very well known. S.L. Huang is a favorite of mine.
I love.
So, you know, super jazzed to see that. I had not heard about the Yukimi Ogawa book. Yeah. And it looks really cool. And it's a debut collection.
Yep.
So, like, it has, like, sort of indie vibes, if you know what I mean.
It
like,
does.
That cover feels very indie to me, which I'm interested in. And the publisher is Mythic Delirium, which I, like, may have never heard of before.
Oh, honestly. That is a great name.
Yeah. Right? Like, that's a solid. So, like, I'm super interested in that. So, yeah, I'm into this list in general. Yeah. Like, are there books that I think should have been on here? Always.
Always. Yeah.
But it's an interesting list. I think it is. Yeah.
Especially when you're paring it down to that size.
Oh, which... 6 is so, I mean, 7, that's like nothing. That's nothing.
It's really not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really excited. Like, I feel like a lot of the SFF that I'm seeing on this is very much bleeding into, like, horror, too. And you can definitely see that with the Our Share of Night representation. I've been wanting to read that book so much. It really taps into the, like, the everyday horrors of things that happen in Latin America are horrifying. Like, just because, you know, and... But I'm a bit of a weenie, and so I haven't been able to get into it all that much. Mm-hmm. And Lecky, I'm actually going to talk about later today, just spoiler. But yeah, it just always reminds me how much I'm not reading. But then maybe part of it is just like you said, that we have other faves that didn't land on this list.
Oh, yeah.
That is, you know, fine. But I am glad to see that it is, you know, relatively diverse. We've got some good representation, so yeah. Good to know.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a solid one, I think.
It is.
All right, let's see. I will pick our next story, and I want to talk about... This is just interesting. The comics is going through a lot, and I thought this story was really interesting. So Marvel Ultimates co-creator Brian Hitch has declared that he is no longer doing work for hire, which is a BFD in the world of comics, because that's almost all of it. I mean, that's all of DC and Marvel is work for hire. And I think a fair amount of Image might be, too, actually. I'm not positive about that, though. So this is reported on the Popverse by Chris Arendt. And yeah, Hitch, I did not know his name, but when you see the work, I'm like, oh, yes, I've read. Like,
exactly.
I read a bunch of the Ultimates, you know, for the MCU and, you know, all of that stuff. And so it's like, okay, yes, totally. And he is just saying, like, yeah, I'm not going to do, I have my own creator-owned series that I'm going to do. And also, I'm just not going to do anything else that I don't. At least in part own. And so Superman will be his last work for hire project. And he's a big deal in comics also. So I just am so curious, like, what the ripple effects of this will be. You know, he's made his career, so he doesn't need to do work for hire anymore. Yeah, he can do this. Exactly. He's able to do this, which is great. I'm sure is everybody's dream, you know, is to actually own the work that they do. Like, imagine, right? I know, like, ouch. But yeah, I just thought this was super interesting, and I'll be kind of keeping my eyes out to see what follow-on stories might happen.
Yeah, I also didn't think I, like, knew much about him until I realized, yeah, especially with the last days of Lex Luthor. I've heard of Lex Luthor, pardon me. It is kind of cool that the last thing he's going to do is, like, the thing that he says really kind of stoked his passion for comics. So at least he gets to go out with that. But yeah, that ownership conversation, I think, could get interesting. They even say in this piece, like, that's a combo for another day.
It sure is. Like, great. It would be a huge reworking of how comics exist in the world if, you know, illustrators, writers, you know, co-creators started to have ownership at the big two. I can't imagine that Marvel and DC are going to get on board with that. Like, I can't. I literally cannot imagine.
Maybe not right now. Yeah, this is definitely the year, it feels like, of the upheaval of the way we do things. But as we've also seen, the people in those, like, positions of power are very, very reluctant to do those things and make those changes. So I guess this will unfold in time.
So we'll be keeping an eye on it.
Yeah. Well, I will pick our next story, which I have many Muppet arms for, which is there is going to be a Sleepy Hollow reboot. He stole my soul, my heart. So writer-director teases upcoming movie will handle the story. This is a story from Screen Rant by Ryan Northrup. So writer-director Lindsay Anderson Beer teased her approach to her upcoming Sleepy Hollow remake. She is the writer and director of the Pet Sematary Bloodlines adaptation. So she says she's going to be using the same approach that she used for that Stephen King adaptation, where she wants to sort of explore the mysteries that were unanswered by a specific piece of source material. And I love when retellings do that, when they take the thing that either was left unsolved or unresolved, or maybe even you didn't think you cared about, like those random little details, and then they just pull at those threads. So it's exciting to me for those reasons. Of course, you all probably know that this is based on Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which was a short story that was released back in 1820. It has seen many adaptations, the one that is arguably the most famous being the Tim Burton version from 1999, the one where old Johnny Depp plays Ichabod Crane and Christopher Walken plays the Headless Horseman. I'd almost forgotten that detail.
Yeah, and Christina Ricci plays the love interest, whose name I have forgotten.
Yeah, I haven't heard it in a while. I think I last remembered it when I watched the Wednesday Netflix series, and I was like, oh yeah, Christina Ricci. I love this story. I love, like, a lot. I love Sleepy Hollow, but I'm really anxious, like, excited to be able to watch an adaptation of it that does not include Johnny Depp, because at least I feel differently about Johnny Depp in 2023 than I did, you know, in 99. And just, I can't get enough of creepy remake stuff. This is very much up my alley, and I'm, excited to see kind of how she shapes that story when she finally takes it on.
Yeah, agree. I definitely saw that in the theaters, I am going to admit. And I had mixed feelings about it, but the vibes were, like, very, you know, it's Tim Burton. Like, that, you know what you're going to get from a Tim Burton. So while I had a lot of quibbles with certain bits of it, the vibes were solid, and I have only more quibbles now. But, you know, yeah, Sleepy Hollow with a female writer director, not for nothing, who, like, has a horror background, all sounds great to me. I mean, I'm never going to watch Pet Sematary Bloodlines. Let's be real.
Neither are the two people in this podcast.
I am a delicate flower. It's not going to happen, but I would take a chance on Sleepy Hollow personally.
As would I.
All right. Well, I'm glad we're on the same place on that. Okay, our last story.
Sorry, I really love this.
It's good. It's a little lightness for a heavy time in the world. So Stephen Graham Jones did a Reddit AMA, which is, you know, great. Amazing. Wonderful. Remind me, Vanessa, have you read Graham Jones?
I have. So, like, again, I'm a resident weenie with Jen, but, like, this year, perhaps perhaps as a reaction to said world conditions, I have found myself seeking out a little bit more horror. As long as I kind of know what I'm getting into. I really liked The Last Final Girl by Stephen Graham Jones, and I would like to try to read some of it. You know, obviously My Heart is a Chainsaw is one that it had so much buzz around it. I would like to read that, but that's the only one of his extensive kind of catalog at this point that I've read. And I assume the answer for you is no, but
nope, I am not. I tried.
I know.
And it was too scary for me. Yes. But I have read a short story, although I can't remember what it was called. Oh, wait, I've read Mongrels, though. I loved Mongrels. Mongrels was fine for me. Okay. Like 100% fine for me. It just didn't go too far into the gore, which was helpful for me. So, like, I'm a huge fan of Mongrels. I can only assume that his other books are good, too, because from what I've heard from readers I trust, they might be too hardcore for me.
I think they are.
But this is a very delightful AMA. I saw you had a favorite one.
Yes. I mean, like, the two comments that are at the top were, like, just a funny juxtaposition, because the first is, like, kind of asking, like, some of the reasons why, like, or I think they asked, what's, like, a misconception people have of you? Mm-hmm. And he said a thing that I have heard from a lot of horror writers was that people sort of assume that he's in it for the gore, the guts, the body count. He's like, no, I'm really here for the hope, which I thought was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And then the very next question asks two questions that are actually like substantive. And then this last one was like, so how do you feel about spicy food? Like, I grew up on spicy food. And I just want to know how you feel about spicy. Like, they just want to know. And it is, I mean, it's an AMA. So, you know, cool. And his response both killed me and made me laugh, because he's like, I avoid all spices. I don't go for flavor. I wish I could take a pill for every meal. I drink a lot of Soylent, but I do like Chipotle. I just was like, get I am going to like burn my insides out from how much spicy food I eat. And this guy's like, I wish I could take a pill for food. Like, I love food is so important to me. Like, the idea. And then there's a lot of people like this, though, right?
That,
don't feel that way. It's like, if I could just take a pill for sustenance. But the idea that he's like, I don't go for flavor, but I do love Chipotle.
I mean, I'll say ouch for Chipotle. Like, yes, you know,
super.
Ah, no sauce on your Chipotle burrito bowl. Like, okay, that's
I think
a vibe.
He said something about how he really likes the black beans or something like that.
Yeah, he likes
that,
the black beans. He likes the, but no sauces. He does not get any sauces. I really, my favorite part of that question was his response about like spicy stuff from his childhood with Chef Boyardee.
Chef Boyardee. I forgot
amazing.
About that part.
Love.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, I think he handles a lot of questions that are, you know, potentially, how do I want to say?
Like, I know what you're going for.
I wouldn't have asked that way.
Yeah.
People have misconceptions about things and don't know how to talk about stuff, and that's real. And so yes, my favorite bit of this was that somebody asked if there would be a sequel to Mongrels, which, like, obviously, I am super into. And his answer destroyed my soul. He says after he published it, he gave the publisher pitches for books 2 and 3, but they said they didn't want me to be the werewolf writer. What?
Why?
What?
Why, I ask?
What? Like, obviously, he should. What, writing 3 books about werewolves makes you the werewolf writer? Like, I'm sorry. I have so many problems. Like, I would like to storm into that conference room where this decision got made and, like, give them a piece of my mind. And I'm glad he's publishing other things, but, like, why would you deny us books 2 and 3 of the Mongrel series? Like, that's just cruel.
And really, in that vein, like, you could say effectively what you decided to do instead was make him the slasher guy. Like, and and that's not a problem. Like, he writes that stuff really well, from what I understand, but given, like, the voraciousness for stuff, like, I just don't understand that decision. But, like, who among us?
It's a terrible choice. So I really, and he says he really wants to finish it. And I hope that this produces some, like, if I was his agent, I would have been, like, sending emails personally.
Justice for Mongrels.
Justice for Mongrels. Thank you. So that's my story.
We just wanted to throw that in because we found
it's
those.
It's a good one. I recommend reading it for sure. All right. So that was our news. We kept it light this week because, you know, there's enough going on in the world. Let's be real. We're going to talk about pet peeves and favorite tropes in just a minute. But first, we're going to hear from another sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
All right. Well, I invented this topic. I mean, invented. I picked this topic.
I invented the pet peeve.
I did not invent the concept of the pet peeve. I didn't. I will not go that far. But so I know how I approached this in my head. Vanessa, what did you like start to think about when you knew this was the topic?
It got a little too broad for me, I'm not going to lie, and I had to rein it in because the list was starting to be just a list of things that have ever annoyed me. And I was like, look, this isn't even like specific to SFF anymore. And actually, the pet peeve that I picked isn't necessarily, but for whatever reason, can happen a lot in SFF. I'll talk about that a little bit, just due to the nature of like having to build worlds and stuff. But yeah, after a while, I tried to just hone it back in and like, what is the thing that really just takes me out of a story? Like something that's going to bother me enough that I will probably DNF it. Whereas like sometimes the stuff that annoys me, like the much, much, much longer list, like I can probably still power through and just, you know, make noises at somebody about it. So that's, and then once I did that, the list actually was significantly smaller. One of, actually a lot of the things we're going to talk about today overlapped with what Jen had already put in the agenda. And I was like, look, we is the same again. And that is fine. Like we can talk about that all day. But yeah, thankfully I was able to pare that down because the list was getting real, real thick. How about you?
Yeah, I have famously, like, in front of an author who wrote one, have talked about my pet peeves. That was an embarrassing moment. But it just, it goes to show, as what I said in the moment, and it was true, that anything done poorly can be annoying, and anything done well can be great, even if it's a thing that normally you don't like. So when I think about my pet peeves, I can always find exceptions, which is why I built that into this agenda. I was like, oh, but here's the exception. Like, just to say that there's, I never 100% don't like a certain thing, because I just haven't maybe read an author who does it in a way that works for me yet. And I know they're out there because it happens to me all the time. Like, oh, I didn't think I wanted this, but when you do it that way, turns out I do. Or like, I usually love this trope, but like the thing you're doing with it is not for me, so like we're gonna skip this. Like, that's, it works for favorites as well as pet peeves, I think.
You're right,
because, you know, in the right hands, any writer can turn any trope into something amazing. So that's sort of where I was coming from, although I did not come up with a book
Neither did I, but...
for one of my pet peeves.
I also just, honestly, and I could be speaking for you, but like, because the pet peeve, two things. One,
let's just talk about it. Let's just go.
Let's get into it. You're right. Okay. So, I will just say, like, my pet peeve, and it's almost like hard to explain, but I'm going to try. When the thing with SFF, especially if it's part of a series, kind of by nature, the first book is probably, if it's doing it correctly, right, it's going to have to do a fair amount of like exposition and world building. Mm-hmm. And especially if that starts to get into dual POV and like timelines. Yeah. And they do that thing where like the narrator or like the point of view is not super clear like right away. I know yes. that it's probably done to build suspense, like whatever. Yeah. But because you're already doing so much exposition, mm-hmm. it can really take me out of the story where I just don't feel invested. Mm-hmm. Or if there's a lot of, which again, SFF, like names and places, and yeah. then I'm also getting two different POVs and the timelines aren't clear, then I'm just like, I is confusion. Mm. But that is a thing that, like in the book that I'm going to talk about, really did actually frustrate me in the beginning, especially once you figure out who the narrator is. And but it was really well done once I figured it out. And then mm-hmm. I was able to push through it. Because again, like we said, it's not a thing that necessarily is going to be bad like forever and ever.
Right.
The flip side of that is that when I started to try to think about books that I didn't like that did it, I'm of two minds. Like one, unless a book is problematic, I sometimes don't like to just go out and like poo-poo it publicly yeah. in like a podcast form because, same. Right? It's like just because it's not for me doesn't mean it's not for somebody. Mm-hmm. And also what has probably happened is that I've DNF'd them and then they've left my brain.
That's right. It's no like more. I never read it.
Never. And I couldn't think of an example, but I know it has happened to me several, mm-hmm. again, especially if it's the start of a series where I'm like, okay, this is too much. Yeah. Brain overload. Gotta go.
Yeah.
So that's yeah. my, should I talk about my pick or do you want to maybe give us some of your pet peeve stuff?
Yeah, yeah. I'll start with my pet peeve. Well, no, you started talking about dual timelines. So tell us about dual POV and timelines that you like. It's not your favorite, but.
But, yes. I think maybe even talked about this book on this podcast before. Mm. And then we talked about the author at the top with the, you know, Publishers Weekly Best. Yes. But the book that I did like that did this was The Raven Tower by Anne Leckie.
Yeah.
And it is weirdly the only Anne Leckie I've read, even though I think the Ancillary Justice series yes. are like way more popular, but this one does dual POV. It hooked me because, spoiler, it also does a thing that is in my faves, which is that it is like a retelling kind of mm-hmm. of Hamlet. So it's like Shakespeare, like mm-hmm. you got me. And so it contains the pet peeve in that it's telling you the story of this guy, you know, Guy Mawat, who just found out that he has to go look for his dad. I'll tell you the plot in a second. But then the whole time you're getting also this like omniscient narration and you're like, who is talking? And it's several chapters before you figure it out. And it starts at like the dawn of time because in this story, so like for centuries, there have been these two gods. There's the god of the silent forest, which protects the land. And then another, there's a capital R raven who, go with me here, speaks through a living bird known as the instrument. So the god is the raven. It acts through a raven. That raven is called the instrument, and the green grass grows all around. So, again, other surrounding kingdoms are protected by other gods, but then this raven is, like, the most powerful one, and then the kingdom is ruled by a human who would think of as, like, a king, but he's known as the Raven's Lease, which, you know, if you know what lease means, it's like, your time here is temporary, because he is given power and authority by the raven, and then at the end of his literal lease, like, agrees that when the bird dies, he also sacrifices himself, and, like, now the new king comes up. That's supposed to be Mawat, and he's on his way to claim that, but then when he gets there, he finds out that his dad has allegedly fled, the bird is dead, and also his uncle has now, like, usurped the bench. So to bring it all back to the narration, you're hearing this person tell you this, and it's because it's a talking rock. It's a rock. It's a god known as Strength and Patience of the Hill. And it actually ends up working in a way that I really was annoyed by, but the rock narration is this cool device that sort of drives home the really rather like ephemeral nature of human existence, like how the events of our history are like a speck in the scheme of things, how history is indeed cyclical. And I ended up really liking because it was like the most omniscient of all omnisciences. It's like, I am a rock who has been here since the dawn of time. And so I've seen how this is going to maybe play out. So I actually really loved it. Anne Leckie is great. I need to read way more of her. But that is a book where I did end up actually liking that dual POV unknown narrator. She really brought it home. So yeah, The Raven Tower by Anne Leckie.
Yeah, so I love that book. And it is, you are just like, what is happening? When
what?
You start that, like, what on earth?
Because those details are straight up like, and then I rolled into the ocean. You're like, what?
Yeah, and you're like, I'm sorry, what? And it's like talking about like physics? And like quantum stuff. And you're like, is this a fantasy novel? Like, what is happening? And you know, Vanessa, I am like embarrassed to say this out loud, but I'm going to anyway.
I'm excited.
I never put together that was like a Shakespeare Hamlet reference.
Okay, I didn't figure it until my second reread.
Okay, because I was like, oh, you're right, like, why didn't I put that ticket two and two? But there you go. I mean, I loved it anyway. Now I love it a little bit more. Yep. So that's a great book. That's a great example. I'm very willing to go along with a mysterious narrator for a while. So that's, yeah,
sometimes it's,
however, what I really struggle with,
I love yours so much,
are time loops.
Yeah.
Is my first peeve that I want to talk about. The problem with a time loop is that there's like 15,000 different ways to decide how time works, right? Like, is it back to the future? Is it, you know, I don't know. There's a million billion, like, is it Looper? Like, there's a million properties out there that play with time travel. Everybody thinks time works differently. Like, can you go back and become your own father? Like, question mark. So and you don't know when you're reading which model the author is using, because they don't, like, tell you.
Yep.
Because that would be ridiculous. And yet, my brain... Anytime you bring up a time loop, my brain goes into overdrive, and I cannot focus on the story because I'm so busy trying to figure out, like, my brain is doing, like, you know, like, I am that math gif of, like, trying to figure out, like, which version of time is happening here, and it drives me bonkers. Time loops drive me absolutely wild. I can't. They just knock me right out. However, that being said, they have been done well. And it was funny when I was like poking around at lists of like, oh, what time loop would I say I really enjoyed? The Good Place, which is not a book, but you know what? I'm gonna go with it anyway.
We're going with
it. I thought like season one, especially of The Good Place, did such a great job with time loops, because I think, and maybe it's because it is so clear exactly how the mechanics work.
Yes.
Like, you don't have to wonder what these mechanics are. It's really obvious. And, like, that means, and then I can just enjoy the ridiculousness of them repeating this, like, you know, experience over and over and over again. And what's going to happen because of that repetition, rather than, okay, but what are the mechanics of the repetition?
Yep.
And, like, do I wish I could just turn that part of my brain off? Absolutely. Can I? No, I cannot. So, like, that is my time loop rant.
Yeah, I kept thinking of that. I don't know if you watched, like, the Avengers movies, but, like, famously, like, the last movie, they're having to essentially go back in time to, like, steal these Tesseracts because, you know, whatever. Yes. And so, like, poor, you know, the Hulk is sitting there trying to explain, like, when you go into the past, like, the past is now your present and the present is your future and, like, all these things. And I always use that same reference of being like the math gif of just being like, so if I'm in the past and then the present and then like the time. And then if you've watched the new Loki series, which is like like time, like my brain breaks. I have to just concentrate on like the objective pleasantness of Tom Hiddleston.
That's real.
Yo no entiendo. So I feel you, friend.
Yeah, it's too hard. My other peeve, since it seemed like you only had one, right?
Because my second one is this one.
Oh, is this also really? Yes. I didn't know we had. Okay, great. So my second peeve is ghost romance. Listen, y'all, I have tried. They're a ghost.
I can't.
They're
romance.
A ghost.
Yes.
I cannot co-sign this. Like, they are, whether or not they can turn corporeal or not, like, whatever, it doesn't matter. They are beyond the realm of the living. And the other person is alive. And, like, you can't, that's an unbridgeable gap. And,
indeed.
Like, I know people find ways to bridge it.
Yep.
But mostly I hate it.
Mostly I hate it. Yes, absolutely.
I don't know. And like people are like, oh, like, you know, like the, speaking of movies, like the movie, literally the movie Ghost, like so romantic. I'm like, not romantic.
No, it's not.
I don't. It's not romantic.
Yeah. People always throw Ghost and Casper at me and I'm like,
oh, Casper. Fight me. Don't even get me started about Casper. I can't.
Today's the Christina Ricci day.
Sorry, Christina. She was great in Wednesday.
Absolutely.
No, I cannot with Casper either. Yeah, it just drives me, you know, and I was thinking about this too, Vanessa, and I don't know if this is true for you as well. So part of it is just like literally you are in two different states of being.
Yep.
And like the hoops that you're going to have to jump through to get everybody on the same plane of existence are going to be too much for me almost always.
Correct.
Right. But also, especially if it's a ghost that's been there for hundreds of years, like the age gap.
Thank you.
I just don't love an immortal with a mortal age gap situation personally. I don't love it.
Yeah. It says the girl who has watched Twilight 900 times, but knows it's problematic.
Right. Exactly. Like it's a, I mean, I just don't, I can't go for it anymore because my brain is too loud about it. Especially it feels different as a grown up. Like when you're like 18, you're like, oh,
this
yes,
great.
This is amazing. Yeah. But like the older you get, the more you're like, no,
like you're 200.
You're 200.
I'm five,
like find a grown up. Like I can't.
Find a grown up. Find a ghostly grown up.
Yeah. That being said, exactly. That's right. So Cemetery Boys,
yes.
Right? Aiden Thomas. And I don't want to like spoiler, but I will just say that the way it is handled.
Correct.
To get the ghost and our main character together is like so smart. So well done.
So smart.
And I was so skeptical. And then I finished the book and I was like, A++++.
Yeah, without spoiling, we can say that it's like a like Mexican-inspired fantasy that's all about like Day of the Dead. You've heard us talk about this several times. But that the setting is obviously lensed part of it and just the magic of it. Like this, literally Jen plucked the like, this is my pet peeve. And then this is the book I would say that like I was able to get over it in because it does work. So like, chef's kiss. In a way that was really satisfying too, and that I hope he does end up writing a. I think he did already say he's writing a sequel for.
Oh, we shall see. Good.
If
I look
you
forward to that.
Like this book, he always puts out such great merch. That's called Graveyard Gaze, or no? Yeah, Graveyard Gaze. I think that's what he calls it. But anyway, usually partners with lots of local artists to like do stuff. So like the profits are going to like cool places, and like it just so happens that one of the characters in this book's last name is Diaz. I love Marigold. I love Day of the Dead. And he has this like soccer jersey that has the name Diaz in the back. So I just rock through the world, people thinking I'm like some kind of soccer player. I'm like, LOL, no. But my last name is Diaz. So
I didn't know that. And I could not love anything more.
It's fantastic.
That's
love
fantastic.
It.
Fantastic. Yeah. So Cemetery Boys is like the one and only time a ghost romance has worked for me.
Every other time I'm screaming at a page or screen.
I'm just like,
so.
No. Unacceptable. No.
No. Unacceptable. Ugh. Well, glad we got that out.
Yeah, so let's talk about favorite things now. You go. I've been ranting
favorites.
For a while. You go.
Yeah, again, Jen and I are sometimes the same person. So, like, and who isn't into cozy? I mean, some people are not. Some people really like dark stuff, and that's great. But, like, cozy is, like, a lane I live in year-round. And so coziness, retellings is a huge one for me. And then for me, it's, like, Jenna's going to talk a little bit about this, but I love just anything that's a sci-fi murder mystery. It doesn't need to like be in a specific setting as long as it's murdery. And I love alternate history stuff. Plus also added, I didn't really talk about this today, but like I love a grumpy reluctant hero. That's I'm thinking very much a book that I've Chilling Effect. Like I didn't want to talk about that because I've talked about it so many times, but stuff like that. And I also really dig, but can also, so this is a category of one that could be a pet peeve or a favorite, like Chosen One books, depending on how they're done. And the one that I'm going to not talk too long about, because it's also one that we've talked about a lot, specifically me, is Her Majesty's Royal Coven, like that series by Juno Dawson. I really dig the kind of flipped idea of the Chosen Ones, and I don't want to, it's kind of spoilery, so I won't do too much, but yeah, the Chosen One, it's much more about like the prophecy and how prophecies can get out of hand, philosophical disagreements on how to handle what prophecies may or may not mean. And so the Chosen One thing is really not as clear and direct as one might think. And in fact, is the entire reason why this group of witches have seen this huge split in their coven. So there's, you know, magical war and high stakes, and it's just really good. And I really, really like that the way that that book handled Chosen One. It's just one of my most fun. There's two books out now, Shadow Cabinet, and oh my gosh, there is a prequel coming out in 2024 that takes place in Tudor England, because Anne Boleyn is the founder, like the original witch in the coven. I could not want that more. So that one's probably not going to be chosen one vibes, but I really dig that particular exploration of that. So that's one of my first. Why don't you tell us a little bit of some of yours?
Yeah, Chosen One is interesting. When I saw you put it on there, I was like, oh, I could take or leave a Chosen One.
I know what you mean. Yep.
Yeah, like, I'm like, eh, I actually prefer, like, the Unchosen One, if that's a thing.
That
like,
might be the, more what I'm talking about.
Who's been overlooked yeah. for the Chosen One spot, but then turns out to be, like, actually yes. the correct person to get the business done.
Super.
I'm going to add Unchosen One to a favorite trope. Yes. Okay. Yep. So that's my first one. Cozy Murder in Space is the first thing I wrote
Love
down.
It.
Because I struggle with the mystery thriller genre when it's realistic, let's say. I will read a cozy mystery, but it has to be cozy. And most mysteries, they just make me freaked out about my own life. Like, I just they feed into my anxiety in the same way that horror does. So I have to be really careful.
Yeah.
Like, if it feels like it could happen to me, I cannot read it as, like, fiction. So this is why, you know, sci-fi and fantasy is yep. so great, because, like, probably none of this is going to happen to me.
I'm probably not going to be on a spaceship.
Probably not going to be on a spaceship and get murdered by my clone. Like, that's
yep.
not going to happen.
Not.
So, like, I'm going to be okay. So I love, and yes, cozy sci-fi, absolutely, like, on the record, love it. But then when you put that together with Murder in Space, and it doesn't have to be cozy, I can hang with regular Murder in Space.
I was gonna say, you can. I know you're
I can.
Reading.
I yeah. can. Yeah, I can do that. Horror in Space, no. It's just too scary. Depending. Although I do love the Alien
I was gonna say,
series.
We have always lived
so,
here,
like,
friend.
Yeah, I know. I can't explain my brain to you right now. So
we contain multitudes, okay?
We do contain multitudes. Oh my gosh, we have always lived here. I can't even. But yeah, so Cozy Murder in Space is like the thing that I've discovered I want more and more of. And so, like, Mer Lafferty, right? I've talked a lot about Mer Lafferty yeah. on this show. Station Eternity came out this year, which is the first in the Midsolar Murders. Get it? Which absolutely has those cozy vibes. I wouldn't call Six Wakes cozy,
no.
Which was Lafferty's first murder in space. But Station Eternity absolutely has some cozy vibes to it, which is awesome. And yeah, it takes place on a spaceship. An amateur detective who is just trying to not be around when people die, of course, gets into, like, you know, a murder on a space station that involves aliens and, like, humans are coming and, like, what's going to happen? It's all very complicated. So much fun and so smartly done. And so, yeah, Mer Lafferty kind of is doing a great job with these. I didn't write it down, but I will also say that Malka Older's new series,
is
like perfect for this. Mimicking of Known Successes also. Like, I could not love that this has become a thing more. Like, I'm just so excited about all of the murder in space. So that's a weird sentence that I just said. But... we'll just leave it there.
I like
That's my first one.
I think it's actually the book you and I talked about together the last time we podcasted on the show.
That's probably
because
right.
it was fall vibes, and I was like, cozy,
yeah.
space, murder. Yeah, really great. Really fun. And the sequel is already
yeah.
out?
I think it's
coming
out.
Coming out next year?
I think it's out.
Okay,
it's,
cool.
It's out soon, if not yet.
Great. That's awesome. Okay, so I will tell you about more of my favorites. So yeah, going back to what I said about a loving just murder mystery in like some kind of sci-fi setting, I do read a ton of mystery, but have absolutely run into the same thing that you describe where like The Trap by Katherine Ryan Howard is a book I recently read. And it's like, man, don't start that like late at night if you're a woman, because like he'd be talking to the woman in his trunk. And I was like, but in mystery in sci-fi or fantasy, it can take you out a little more, right? Because there's like interesting stuff going around, like steampunk things like the one I'm about to talk about, which also combines murder mystery with alternate history. And that is Master of Gin by P. Jelly Clark. I started reading P. Jelly Clark, I think at Jen's suggestion, actually. And I'm a huge fan of these Dead Djinn universe books. There's two novellas that came first, I think, at Dead Djinn and Cairo and Haunting of Tramcar 015. And so this is the first full length. Can be read as a standalone in any order. They do a pretty good job of giving you like the lay of the land in the beginning. And this is set in an alternative steampunk version of Cairo in 1912. And it's about this... investigator named Fatma, who is the youngest woman, I think one of the only women working for this really specific ministry that goes through and investigates mysteries of a, or like crime of a alchemic, enchanted, supernatural, you know, variety. And so there's been this sort of mass murder of a bunch of folks that were part of a brotherhood dedicated to this mystic and inventor who a long time ago was said to have ripped like the veil open between the magical world and the non-magical world. And he's supposed to, like, he disappeared, but he's supposed to kind of be living. And the idea, the person who like claimed responsibility for this crime is saying that he is that like long disappeared mystic. So she has to figure out, like, is it really him? Who did it? Whatever. But this alternate history part comes in because in this world where the magical and the mundane like exist alongside each other, the other crucial detail is that the like this version, this universe is not like Cairo is not subject to European colonial rule. In fact, most nations aren't. So there's just a lot of little intricacies that are put in there that is like a very, very strict condemnation of colonialism.
Yeah.
And the way that it unrolls with all the like technological fun stuff in the back and the fact that you do get stuff like angels and djinn alongside the humans. It just does all of those things that I love, where there's a murder mystery to be solved. It's got enough elements that take you out of real life to not feel like it's a thing that's going to maybe happen to you. And then those cool explorations of like gender and class and colonialism, like with that steampunk vibe, lots of queerness. It's just such a fun book and I loved it so hard. So yeah, that's Master of djinn by P.J. Le Clercq, with murder mystery and alternate history fun times.
Yes, I agree with all of that. I mean, I was a history major, so anytime somebody is messing with history, it's like music to my ears.
So good.
And yeah, Clercq is incredible. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous. So good. Right. So I have three, sort of. And my second favorite, I mean, I could have listed favorites forever, but I was trying to narrow it down. So my second favorite is a spaceship crew just out here trying to survive.
Like,
love a crew just trying to make it in a tough world. I know I am not alone because, you know, the success of The Expanse or Firefly or, you know, any number of other Becky Chambers, like, we all love it, right? We all love, like, they're just, Chilling Effect is another good example. Chilling Effect, like, they're all just out here trying to make it happen. And one of the books we've talked about on the show before, but I have to shout it out here because it's both murder in space and a spaceship crew just trying to survive, is The Deep Sky by Yume Katase. And it is, oh, this book, right? Like, it's like, okay, so a bunch of people who have been selected for this mission, because Earth is, you know, not in great shape. they've all been selected. They've been trained. They trained together. And they all can have children. They are, you know, of different genders, but they all have the capability to gestate a child. And so they're on this mission to, like, you know, take humanity to the stars. And things start going wrong. People die. It's all very complicated. Half of the crew is pregnant at any given moment. Like, it is very stressful. It is very stressful. And if you are pregnant or are, like, triggered by pregnancy related things, like, do not read this book. Don't read it. It's not for you right now. But if that's not a thing that you're trying to avoid, I just love how you get this like close-knit crew of people who know each other so well and like don't all love each other, because a lot of the times the people we've grown up with and trained with and are in extreme circumstances with, like, we want to strangle them, right? Like, we're just like, oh my gosh, I will murder you for, like, you know, snort laughing one more time. Like, I just can't listen to you do this thing anymore. But also, you are all bound together for survival. And so what happens? So I thought she handled that just so incredibly well.
Ooh, I love that. I haven't read that one yet. I'm interested now.
It's great. Mm-hmm. I got Sharifa to read it too, and she really liked it. So we are together on that wreck.
So good. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, I will give you my third one and final one then. And this is also a retelling, but I just recently was reminded of it because I was recommending it to someone. I was like, oh yeah, I read that, I think this year, and what is time? But I loved this retelling. And it's actually of a book that I have never read the original for, but I had seen the movie, so whatever. But it's The Daughter of Dr. Moreau by Celia Moreno Garcia, who is absolutely one of my, like, auto-read authors. I say this not having read Silver Nitrate because, again, life has been lifing, but I will read that soon. This is a clear retelling remix of The Island of Dr. Moreau, but this one is set in the Yucatan, And the main character is this like young woman who's grown up on this sort of remote but very luxurious estate where she has been very removed and kept safe from all the conflict that's going on in the Yucatan Peninsula. She's the only daughter of that doctor who like might be a genius, might be losing it. And then like this, he has this family of like benefactors and the son of whom has like arrived at this house within his eyes pretty much set on like Carlota. And it makes a whole bunch of things pop off. And of course, on the side, we have this whole family of beings called hybrids, which is the result of her dad's research, is that he's created these part human, part animal beings whose destiny is to obey their creator and sort of remain in the shadows and very much kept hidden from like the rest of the world. So again, when like an outsider comes in, very much wants to get with Carlota and like kind of take things over. Just things kind of explode from there. And I loved the retelling just because the setting, first of all, was different. It really goes into the, like, how isolation really does just create a hotbed and perfect conditions for the abuse of power when you combine it with a culture where, like, filial piety is a really, really big deal. Mm. And all of those explorations, plus the social inequalities and exploitation, really, I don't know, she remixed, as she often does, like, remix the story in a way that was really, really interesting to me and that gave that story a new layer, again, from the cinematic version that I've seen. But this is the kind of thing, again, I said I'd liked in retellings when someone kind of pulls at a thread or just changes, even just by changing someone's identity or culture, and makes some dynamic about the original story so much more interesting and relevant for like a current audience that she does that so well. So yeah, I really love this book.
Strong cosign. I read and loved that book this year too. So good. Yeah, just like genius. The sort of like sequel, quote unquote, as it were, to a classic has happened a couple of times this year in retellings, and I'm extremely here for it. I love it. Retellings, like, obviously. Like, I don't know how like much more obvious that is. So this is really just an excuse for me to shout out. We talked about S.L. Huang earlier because she's on the best of for PW for Water Outlaws. But I, retellings wise, I can't not talk about Burning Roses, which just like blew my brain out of my skull. Like, if you had told me that, because I had read Huang's novels before this. I hadn't read her short fiction. And then this is like, Red Riding Hood, a Red Riding Hood retelling that also involves Wuyi the archer. And like, it melds so many disparate influences together as if it was like the most natural thing in the world. And it's such a feat of storytelling. And the story never goes in the direction that I'm expecting it to. Like this novella feels so much bigger on the inside. You've got like toxic relationships and you've got like regrets and choices and you've got, I don't know, sunbirds and like regretting like the murders of your, I don't even know. There's so much going on. I'm stumbling for words because there's just so much in here. It's so juicy. It's so deep. There's so many layers to it. And it is also retellings in a way that I like in a million years would never have been like, you know what somebody should write is this. Like, what? This, no, yeah. I would never have come up with it. So it just makes me so happy. So if you have not picked up Burning Roses yet, which I just am realizing is actually part of a series.
Who knew?
There's two more. I did not know, but now I know, so I'm gonna have to read those. But yeah, really good, really, really good.
I really want to read The Water Outlaws now.
Yeah,
I know it's different, but it's
so
like
exciting.
Heisty and eat the rich.
Yes, yes. Huang is so good at action and like character. It's just, so perfect, so good, so good.
And those are our faves.
Those are our favorites. Yeah, that was fun.
It was
right?
super fun.
That was fun. I just like to talk about it because I think that it's easy to get stuck on, well, I like this kind of book, but not this kind of book.
Yep.
And like, it's shorthand, right? It's useful.
Yes.
When you go into the bookstore, you know kind of what you want. But it's a good reminder that, again, in the right hands, like yes. anything can be done in a way that might work for you. So it's good to keep an open mind.
Can you tell we recommend books for a living?
Can you tell? I know. Oh, so funny. Now you can't take the bookseller out
of can't. It's forever going to be there. Yeah.
No. Forever.
This was a lot of fun.
Yay. Well, thank you for coming on, Vanessa.
Absolutely. Anytime you want me on to talk my feelings.
I mean, I was going to say, we're going to see you for our best of show, right?
Yep. So. I will be here.
Yay. All right. SFF Yes, sound edited by Caitlin Brame. So many thanks to her for making us sound great each and every episode. For more recommendations, you can check out bookriot.com. You can find our other podcasts at bookriot.com/listen. As always, thank you so much for listening. You can email us, sffyeah@bookriot.com. Send us your theme ideas. Maybe you have some pet peeves or favorite tropes you'd like to tell us about. Maybe you would like to violently disagree with us about ghost romance, which, like, knock yourself out. You could also review us on Apple Podcasts. We would love that too. Spotify, Podchaser, wherever, leave a review. It helps other people find the show. Speaking of finding, Vanessa, where can people find you?
I am mostly still on Instagram and then, like, a little bit on Blue Sky at Buenos Dias SD. I'm trying to find my way there, but I'm old.
Yes.
Very and good. You?
Well, I'm still on social media break, and I probably will be until
good for
at
you.
Least February. Yeah, it's my yearly ritual at this point, and I you know, every year I'm like, will I go back? Like,
we'll stay tuned. Is what I say.
Yeah, I am not sad about it, but you can find out what I'm up to at jennirl.com. That's jennirl.com, and we will talk to you next time.
Bye.